So Daniel's going to be doing the talk today on Western Maoism after Mao. Daniel's a student out at Monash University and a member of Socialist Alternatives, so he'll speak and then we can have some discussion afterwards.
Okay, cool. Thank you. So, well, firstly, I have to correct the title of this talk. This is not actually about Western Maoism after Mao. It's about Australian and American Maoism, just regular time, because Mao died quite late. So if anyone's here because they wanted to hear about Italian Maoism in the 80s, leave now, because I'm just not going to talk about that. Okay, good. So these are Maoists. This is the work. Yeah, this is the Worker Student Alliance at Monash University. So the student Maoists kind of at their peak. What they're doing here is they're occupying the careers and appointments office at Monash Uni, and you see they've got a Vietnamese National Liberation Front flag that they've hung up in there. This is sort of, I think, how a lot of people picture Maoists in their prime, as it were, as the kind of the radical militant wing of the student movement, cool jackets, doing defiant stuff. The students who went through a process of, or were influenced by people who went through the process of being involved in the anti-war movement against Vietnam and then taking up broader political questions through considering armed struggle and then revolutionary politics. And a lot of them were won over to what they would have described as Marxism-Leninism, Mao Zedong thought. And that was very much the case in parts of the student movement in the United States and in Australia as well. You could say the national leadership at a certain point of the US student movement, a big chunk of it, saw by the end of the 1960s Maoism as a strategy for winning the struggle to end the Vietnam War and for winning a socialist revolution in the United States before just exploding and splintering into many, many pieces that all disintegrated very rapidly. There was a really powerful current in the Australian student movement of Maoism, especially in Melbourne here and also in Adelaide. It got the allegiance of some of the most prominent, famous, influential student leaders in the 60s and 70s, but as well in Australia, a number of really important trade union militants and trade union officials who were sometimes militant and sometimes not. It's interesting to compare American and Australian Maoism, I think. They, you know, both, as I say, had somewhat prominent Maoist currents in their radical movements of the 60s and 70s. They're both advanced capitalist countries, imperialist countries, totally unlike then the China, backwards China of the 1940s, where Mao had originally come to power. They're both countries that invaded Vietnam, and their Maoist movements were both closely interrelated with the movement against the Vietnam War. They had a different approach to the or connection to the working class movement. So that's an interesting point of comparison as well. In the US, they were in a country where the working class movement was much less an autonomous and independent political force, whereas Australia had a very strong tradition of working class politics, relatively, and that influenced how the Maoist currents developed in those two countries. And I think it's of interest to us to analyse now, partly just to consider the question which is re-emerging in a sense of whether there can be what Maoism proclaimed itself to be, a radical revolutionary form of Stalinism. It's hard to say what it is, Maoism, because Mao himself led a peasant militia to state power, and Western Maoism is sort of hard to define because that was not an option or a strategy that was available to people in the United States or in Australia. There's a lot of slogans that are associated with Maoism. Two-line struggle, serve the people, mass line is a good one, block of four classes, power flows from a barrel of a gun, dare to struggle, dare to win, which you can still see on some of the CFMEU's merchandise. There's a slogan from the quotations of Chairman Mao, but if you try to put it together into a coherent worldview or sort of a strategy or even just a set of tactics, it's quite hard to outline, well, what precisely is Maoism. And it combines things that can seem really contradictory. So on the one hand, you associate it with combativity, radicalism, militancy, violence is strongly associated with Maoism in politics. And then alongside that, a real social conservatism, often really old-fashioned attitudes towards sex and drugs, patriotism, really intense patriotism in some instances. Sometimes they would position themselves as the only authentic, really proletarian working class current in leftist politics, and sometimes they were quite openly and bitterly hostile to the working class in their own countries and saw them as, in a sense, the enemy. Some people were drawn to it because they thought it was a sort of a free-spirited, principled, subversive. It wasn't like the old left of the 1930s that, you know, the traditional communist parties represented. But yet it was also associated with this incredibly strict loyalty to the legacy of Stalin, and then after him Mao, and then whatever was the local Maoist leader that might, you know, represent a nearby equivalent of Mao. And even though it had years as a really prominent current in radical politics in both of these countries, really, in terms of healthy Maoist organisations, ones that seem to have some kind of a future, I don't think you could say one of them survived the 1970s in the United States or Australia. In terms of talking about it, people often talk about its origins with reference to the New Left and the student movement, the anti-war movement. The origins of it are earlier. You want to look to understand, and I think that's important to understand its nature, the origins of it in the Stalinist movement, the communist parties in the 1950s, which at that point were in a really difficult situation under a lot of pressure for a lot of reasons. They'd been through and had enforced and endured a lot of shifts in line emanating out of Russia. As the Russian government shifted its priorities and its diplomatic approach, they'd shifted their approach and changed their position. And that had, you know, their shift in World War II had been towards repressing strikes, collaborating with bosses and enforcing a real kind of a flag-waving patriotism and seeking very close relationships in the US with the Democrats and here with the Labour Party. And then after it, after the war was over, their reward was just getting persecuted. The Communist Party of Australia was banned in 1951. They got it overturned, but they were still getting chased around. They were being hounded in the trade unions by the right-wing industrial groups, the groupers, who were trying to totally purge any communist influence out of the trade unions and the Labour Party, and their membership went down by some of the accounts from 25,000 to around 5,000 over a couple of decades as they got sort of driven or people tried to drive them into isolation. In the US, the situation was way worse even. They had a tiny communist party, minuscule really, and it was having through the 50s, 40s and 50s, its leaders and its members, but then just its supporters sacked from their jobs, blacklisted, put in prison. The lawyers that defended them were put in prison. They were really under pressure, heavy, heavy pressure. And one thing that was reassuring to them and helped get them through this period was their associations with these really powerful foreign governments, the Russian and the Chinese governments. And you know, they had a mythology around it. Stalin was the, you know, this military genius who'd saved the world from the Nazis. Mao had led a revolution that, in a way that, you know, even Marx could not have predicted. And, you know, that gives you a psychological and a material payoff. That's Ted Hill, from the Communist Party of Australia, visiting with Mao, the man himself. The Australian Stalinists had a really close relationship with the Chinese, relatively. So there were a whole bunch of leading Communist Party figures who'd spent sometimes literally years in China on what they called study trips. By 1961, there was more than 100 leading Australian Stalinists who'd been over to China to learn, and they were given, you know, red carpet treatment. They were often, you know, treated as heroes or equals to the leading figures in the Chinese state. And China also gave them a bit of a hope that, for all the problems they're experiencing, that some form of Stalinism was kind of on the advance. And maybe it could be refreshed with the new insights that were coming from the Chinese experience. But then it all went horribly wrong. In the middle of the 1950s, after Stalin's death, there was a series of crises that just ended in a massive split and the birth of Maoism. So the new bureaucratic leadership of the Russian government, as people will know, Khrushchev quite quickly made a denunciation of Stalin that completely shocked the international Stalinist movement. He said basically everything that the hated Trotskyists and the capitalists had been saying for decades was true, that Stalin had been a tyrant. He'd framed and killed his political opponents, completely unprincipled, lying, and all of the stuff that the communists had had to go out and say was actually not true. They'd been tricked. Everything that their enemies had been saying all along was correct. That's what Khrushchev said. And the Stalinist leaderships of the communist parties had to decide what to do about this. They could try to accept it, I guess, that they'd, you know, they'd spent decades living a lie politically. They could have some internal debate about what to do about it. They could denounce the whole thing or say it was a forgery. They had to figure out, is this some kind of new openness that could lead in a positive direction, or is this just a crazy gamble that might blow the whole movement apart and destroy everything? And then the stakes were raised even higher when the reform movement in Hungary in the 50s developed into a workers' uprising, which was then eradicated physically by that new Russian leadership. So in the American Communist Party was already pretty fucked. They were reeling from a number of problems and very small, and this just further drained their confidence. And the Australian Party was paralysed for most of that year until this guy Ted Hill came back from his trip to China in September and just said, no more discussion, there will be no more party debates about these revelations, the time for discussion is over, we're getting back to work. Very hard-headed bureaucrat, strict enforcer of both the Russian and Chinese lines. He sacked anyone, demoted them, reassigned them if they wanted to carry on debating the revelations. Then the Chinese government intervened because they had their own issues that were going to provoke the split. The Russian government, which was at this point promoting peaceful coexistence with the West, wasn't giving enough aid money and had other sort of rivalries with the Chinese. And the Chinese government embarked on a political strategy that started with a bunch of public polemics against the Russians that were initially really shocking and disturbing to the World Stalinist movement that had had these very close relationships with both the Russians and the Chinese. Chinese government began putting things out that said, first of all, the Russian government was not revolutionary. It was accommodating to capitalists. It didn't want to support revolutionary movements anymore. It believed in a peaceful transition to socialism, which Marx had proven impossible. It was encouraging communist parties to praise imperialists like JFK. The attacks on Stalin proved that that Russia had been taken over by pro-capitalist revisionists, was the term that they used a lot. They began saying, you know, the Russians are cowards, and you can tell by the fact that they're so scared of a nuclear war. Maybe a nuclear war wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. And very, you know, taboo suggestion. They began to suggest that perhaps the capitalist class had taken over in Russia and Khrushchev was their political pawn. So then what do you think of that if you're a Stalinist? Well, either the socialist motherland in Russia has been taken over by capitalists or the Chinese government has completely lost the plot. And they called a number of international conferences of Stalinist parties to try and resolve this and they all failed. For some people, though, and it starts off disturbing, for some people there was a reassuring element to all of this because there are some people, they spent their lives defending Stalin only to have Khrushchev get up and say he was a tyrant. Now the Chinese were coming out swinging with a full-throated defence of Stalin. That's a celebration of Stalin's birthday in China. Some people agreed the Communist parties had become too conservative, too right-wing, and, you know, wanted some solution to that. And some people, some of the bureaucratic figures who'd been trained in Communist Party politics, got the message that if you split away with a big enough group now, you could be the unchallenged leader of your very own Communist Party and you get the backing from the Chinese government. So in the USA, that message was received by a guy called Milt Rosen. He was their industrial organiser. He'd just failed to get elected onto their national committee, and he began going around arguing what the Chinese were saying, which is that the party needed to start preparing for a civil war in the United States. So he got expelled in 1961 and formed a group called the Progressive Labour Party, and they put out a newspaper challenge, which the Chinese government immediately began buying 2,000 copies of every edition, so they got a big influx of funding that way. But it's still a really small group, a couple hundred people, mostly in New York, San Francisco. A couple of years later, Ted Hill, that same hatchet man of the leadership, who was based in Australia, in Melbourne, he split away as well. And according to some accounts, this is after he'd gone around the Communist Party of Australia, arguing they needed to set up branches in mountainous regions so that they would be easy to defend in case of, again, a civil war. I don't know why you're laughing. Civil war is a serious question. So he set up the Communist Party of Australia Marxist-Leninist, and likewise, they had their own newspaper, Vanguard, pretty much just Hill's supporters at the start in Melbourne. There were similarities, obviously, between these two groups, the PL, as they were called in the US, and the CPAML in Australia. They had, you know, the backing of the Chinese at the start. They coming out of these splits in the public polemics, they focused a lot on very hyped-up denunciations of all their enemies, including the revisionist communist parties, They also had differences in approach, partly just reflecting the leading people in them. Progressive Labour were a really aggressively outward-looking group, and things were picking up in the US, and they got a lot of attention and some young recruits. They played a part in some riots that took place in Harlem, which brought them to prominence. They organised some protests against the House Un-American Activities Committee, and they got a lot of attention from a daring stunt. It was actually pretty good, because there was a blockade on Cuba at this time, and they organised for 100 students to illegally go to Cuba and, you know, break the blockade and go and study at the foot of the leaders of the Cuban Revolution. And that got a lot of attention and a lot of press and brought PL to a lot of prominence. In 1964, where anti-war activism was still a pretty new and developing phenomenon in the United States, they started their own, by some accounts, the first dedicated anti-war student group. So a student campaign group against the Vietnam War, started by PL. On the other hand, the Australians, the CPAML, were very, very secretive, which was suited to Ted Hill's very authoritarian style of organising. So you just sort of get your orders from above and carry them out. You never know, you never knew who was a member. You kept your membership secret. It was an underground organisation in case there was a civil war. So that meant they were practically invisible, probably really, really small. One bitter ex-member a little bit later said, "The CPAML is Hill, half a dozen of his friends in the Victorian trade unions, and a weekly that nobody reads." It's worth saying, though, those friends included some prominent trade unionists, because the Communist Party of Australia that these guys had split out of was a bit of a different beast from the American Communist Party, and when they split away, they actually took some people in Melbourne who had some influence in certain trade unions. So you get these two small groups, Maoism, in these two countries, that have pretty much been started as manoeuvres to get Chinese backing, but they started at a really good time. There were new social movements that were developing at that time that would very quickly outpace the old right-wing communist parties, and there were a number of people who would be looking for some alternative political worldview that accommodated and explained the fact that the communist parties that existed were so right-wing. And China's public polemics contributed to that. They helped create a sort of a Maoist influence. Common sense. There are a bunch of intellectuals who read them, took them seriously, and, you know, encouraged it to be taken up as a worldview more broadly in society, like the people that put out the American magazine Monthly Review, which was quite widely read on the left. And, you know, there are a number of oppressed groups in, you know, in the US that were inspired by anti-colonial movements that were interested as well in Maoism as a way to, you know, provide a worldview for that. And then the Cultural Revolution started in China, where, you know, Mao, in a bureaucratic dispute effectively within the leadership of the Chinese government, tried to break out of it by mobilising students and young people. He took up the slogan, "There's a bourgeoisie within the Communist Party itself," and that had to be fought by the youth. And then as a student movement develops in Australia and the US, Maoism seems to be the perfect match for it. It's about mobilising students and young people against bureaucratic and bourgeois Communist parties themselves. So this all added to their prestige and their confidence and their momentum, and they had organisations set up, ready to go in advance to argue for their politics. So there's been a lot of discussions in our conferences and elsewhere, obviously, about the student movements and the opposition to the Vietnam War and stuff. Won't go into the detail of it. In the US, people might know the Students for a Democratic Society emerged as a period, as a sort of a key national group in the student anti-war movement. They organised a big anti-war march in 1965. 25,000 people went to it. And that was when Progressive Labour decided to enter Students for a Democratic Society. This was a really important moment in the development of the anti-war movement. They were at a point where they'd been having these marches and they were building, but they felt like that wasn't making progress towards ending the war. It was when black urban rebellions were starting to break out, and the student left in America was like the most ideological and sort of the independent bit, as it were, of the anti-war movement. Now, trying to settle at this point on a kind of a worldview and a strategy to end the war in Vietnam. Whole bunch of factors worked against PL for getting accepted in SDS. They wore suits and ties. They made their members shave off their moustaches when they joined. They said that taking drugs was degenerate, and they denounced pretty much everything that they weren't directly in charge of. So the black riots, they denounced. The Black Panther Party, they saw it as a rival and attacked it in the most over-the-top terms, which was not a good way to relate to students at that time who were quite inspired by these phenomena. And they were ultra-workerist, by which I mean, for example, they argued against measures that would help, that would allow more black students to encourage universities, because I said it'll just make black people bourgeois if they go to university and learn all this filth. So ultra sort of stupidly workerist in a not constructive way, but very dedicated, relatively experienced, and they didn't go away. And they had a strategy for SDS that they were arguing for, which was a worker-student alliance, that the student group should campaign alongside working-class people, workers at the universities, for example, to stop the working-class communities near the university, to stop universities expanding by bulldozing their homes, serve the people, as Mao would say, and then build a base of support for the Mao students amongst the working class. It was a strategy. And when they couldn't win people over directly to that strategy, they had another innovation that they also introduced into the student movement at that time, which was just beating people who didn't agree with them. And they brought in a new intensification of violence into the student movement's internal debates. It had an impact. What one person who participated in the student movement at that time said, just about everybody who considered herself or himself even sympathetic to communism thought progressive labour was the most radical version of communism. The most pro-working class, the most militant, the most worked out, and the most radical. They had a really simple, clear strategy, the workerism, and the worker-student alliance, and a political discipline that meant you had to have some kind of a political response to them. And in a few years, under the pressure from progressive labour, pretty much everyone involved in SDS was some kind of a Maoist. If you were going to fight PL, you were going to fight them by saying you were an even better Maoist than what they were. And through that method, even if people didn't join PL directly, they created Maoist student organisations effectively all around the United States through SDS, divided into a whole bunch of different factions and then split apart in 1969. But that's sort of the peak of Maoism's influence in the student movement in the US. But what Maoism? Mao always said that he was just an orthodox Marxist-Leninist. And he, as I said, the way he came to power was almost impossible to apply directly in the United States. For PL, what Maoism meant, the sort of macho economistic focus on what they called proletarian economic struggles, get a mass base amongst the working class by doing that, meaning get a lot of workers to just support you as their leadership. Then you launch an insurrection. So it still has with it, even though it's, you know, seen as the most radical version of communism, authoritarian attitude towards the working class. You're winning over their support so that then you can then use them to launch you into power, and a really intense sectarianism that they brought over from their Stalinist training. It's in some ways it's quite similar to the way the Communist Party's acted around 1930 in their third period. Then there were the newer student Maoists who saw themselves as PL's enemies and wanted to get rid of them on the train of Maoism. They were more influenced by the Monthly Review type people, but very much by the Black Panther Party. And they had a totally different set of worldviews in many ways. There were variations on it, but in a lot of them thought that their role wasn't to build a mass base amongst the American working class, that they were basically behind enemy lines support for the real revolutionaries, who were the Vietnamese, the Black Panther Party, maybe some of them said someday the Chinese government launching a nuclear attack on the United States. Mao to them had proved that just through force of will and effort and violence, you can do anything, especially with armed struggle. You can do anything if you really try, with or without working class support. One of their student leaders gave a perspective speech where he said, if the basic struggle in the world today is the struggle of the oppressed peoples against US imperialism, then it is the case that nothing we can do in the mother country could be adventurous. We can't be adventurous while there is genocide going on. There was a more worked out version of it, which was if you fight the police and whatever like crazy, your courage will inspire and win the loyalty of oppressed people who are also engaged in physical combat, and you'll provoke a violent pushback from the state that will then radicalise large swathes of people and launch a civil war that way. And with some variations, that sort of set of premises took root amongst a big part of the student left. And it was boosted by the riots that happened, the black riots in the cities, the third world guerrilla movements, and also just a sense that there was a really urgent need to do something right now to end the Vietnam War. You had to do something. And the Maoist argument that you can do anything, just go for it, satisfied that need. That's effectively, I'd say, a return in strategy to the pre-Marxist anarchism, because it's about saying basically the working class is irrelevant. They could be good, but they're not decisive. They could actually be your enemy. What matters is heroic effort and violence just by the dispossessed generally, the globally dispossessed people, whoever they may be, whatever their class position may be, and their advocates, or their would-be leaders, the student Maoists in this case. And neither one of these strategies worked. The really small groups of students that tried to directly confront the US state ended up being infiltrated by police, arrested, driven underground, some of them were killed, some of them put in prison, but moreover, they were just treated with contempt by the masses who they thought they were going to radicalise through their daring heroism, but who they never had any direct contact with. And progressive Labour's real authoritarian and sectarian approach meant that no matter how workerous they were, they never could build that mass base amongst the working class they were looking for. And they really quickly became almost a completely isolated sect. So you had this quite promising, radicalising student left emerging out of the anti-war movement, and Maoism just drove it into a ditch and let it take up a whole series of dead-end strategies. In Australia, after some hesitation, the Australian Maoists tried to relate to the student movement. So in 1967, Ted Hill gave a speech to students about the Cultural Revolution in China, and he said maybe students in Australia could play a revolutionary role similar to like what they're doing in China right now. And after working on this in Melbourne, they got a few of the key student leaders to secretly join the CPA-ML. And they began fighting for what they perceived as a Maoist orientation in the various forums that existed of the student movement at that time. Monash was particularly well-known as a base of Maoism. So as in the United States as well, you could get this very relatively small current of organised members of the Maoists, but quite a broad layer of people, would have been thousands of students who consider themselves some kind of radical revolutionary, broad layer of people who became an audience of sympathisers for the Maoists on a whole series of different campuses and different campaigns. The Maoists here, the CPAML's members, imitated Progressive Labour's Worker Student Alliance thing, but they had a lot more success. The Worker Student Alliance here had dozens and dozens of branches by the late part of the 1960s. And there's a legitimate reason for its popularity amongst parts of the student left, because at a certain point it was a premise of being a radical that you have a working class orientation, at least among some parts of the radical movement. And a worker student alliance on paper is not a bad idea. There were frequent strikes in Australia. They were growing. There were the leftist trade union officials who were well known public figures. The ALP had interaction with the anti-war movement and the student movement. So all this made the openly anti-working class Maoism that you got in the United States a bit less prominent here. Via the CPAML, the Workers' Student Alliance at Monash had links to the Waterside Workers Federation, and they campaigned around a combination of things, bread and butter economic issues for working class standard of living, and political questions in broader society, like the war in Vietnam. Although always in these Workers' Student Alliance things, in the discussions of the CPAML, by all accounts, they were disturbed by and didn't know exactly what to do with the fact that non-Maoists were actually participating in them as well. And the student Maoists had a lot of similar properties to the Americans. So they were very sectarian. They were very keen on physical violence inside and outside the movement, especially against their political enemies, especially against the Trotskyists, who they despise. They liked to, if they could, turn demonstrations into battles with the police, and then they'd be the star of the show. And that could sometimes introduce combativity and a liveliness that could have a degree of resonance amongst students, or it could just, again, drive it into a brick wall of just stupid, endless confrontation, which actually that occupation of at Monash was a small example of, where they just ended up, for a whole period, the movement against the Vietnam War at Monash was all about these Maoists who were getting expelled for doing that occupation. They enjoyed the attention they got and also the bureaucratic control that they sought out. So celebrity, but also conspiracy. They'd organise secretly. They'd be secret members. They never wanted to confess that they were members of the CPAML, although you could kind of tell because, like, when Albert Langer ran in the Monash Student Association elections and his elections ticket information said, I think we need to apply the teachings of Mao Zedong to the struggle in Monash, you could kind of get a bit of a sense that, there was something going on. But they organised secretly, so they're hard to hold to account, but they would have their photos everywhere, always making speeches. They had the same Stalin worship, which sat a little bit uneasily with the kind of student rebel thing. But there was one distinguishing thing about them compared to the Americans that really stood out, which they took over from the CPA but really intensified and came to define them, which was a really super, super intense Australian nationalism. So these are some of the Maoist output later. I'll come back to it. They hated the right-wing opportunists of the old communist parties. But hadn't Stalin himself said, you've got to ally with progressive capitalists in the struggle against fascism and imperialism? Hadn't he allied with Winston Churchill, for example, and FDR? That was Stalinist common sense, and they brought it over wholesale. And then hadn't the Chinese government said that allies in the struggle against imperialism are, quote, not only the workers, peasants, intellectuals and petty bourgeoisie, but also the patriotic national bourgeoisie and certain kings, princes and aristocrats who are patriotic. So in Australia, what this meant after a point for the Maoists was the cause of, as they put it, Australian independence. Ted Hill said, imitating the Chinese, the main forces for independence here meaning from whoever, from the Americans at most times, but other people as well, the Japanese, for example, the main forces for independence are the workers, allied to other working people, Australian capitalists, and other patriotic people. So pretty much everyone. And if you look at demonstrations from this time and you see someone holding up a placard saying, for an independent Australia, that means there's secret Maoists about. This is the Blinky Bill Bush band, which the Maoists took touring around prisons and strikes and whatever, trying to inculcate a love of authentic Australian patriotism amongst the working class. This is Take the Mickey Out of Moomba, when scandalously Mickey Mouse was crowned, or to be crowned, king of Moomba, and the Maoists organised an intervention whereby Blinky Bill was going to take him on and stormed the Moomba Parade to do battle with Mickey Mouse. And they organised, they're very proud of this actually. If you look it up online, you can find out who did it and their interviews with, you know, what it was like, the experience of taking on Mickey. They organised, I can give you a sense of how low it went. They toured around at one point farmers in the countryside to warn them against the threat that Japanese investment posed to the cause of Australian independence. It's hard to see what's, you know, where you get from communism to this, that this is stuff that Dick Smith or Pauline Hanson, frankly, could get around. But in a sense, it was just an intensified version of that nationalism that was a big part of the common sense of the Australian left as well. It's got a logical connection to reformism, which does want to have a degree of class collaboration and control national states. If it connects to reformism, that means it connects to Stalinism, which is in many cases just a variant of it, and therefore it gets brought over into Maoism as well. And as a result, you have the most obviously reactionary elements of Stalinism, given a sort of a radical or combative veneer, and then introduced into the student movement that is actually was seeking a path away from the kind of old-fashioned conservative patriotic leftism. So the Maoists, again, took some of the most militant and ideological parts of the student left and convinced them to be Australian patriots and class collaborators. So then what do you say, what is it? Now, there's a lot of leftist currents that have made mistakes, maybe not exactly of this kind, but there's a lot of leftist currents make mistakes, strategic and tactical mistakes. Is there some problem in Maoism that leads it to these kinds of mistakes? I think there is, and the core of it is that it's an unreconstructed Stalinism, and that the Stalinist origins of it, its adherence to Stalinism as a defining founding feature, are what ultimately killed it. It started off with hatred of Khrushchev's partial semi-denunciation of Stalinism. That being rejected was the birth of Maoism, in a sense. That meant they saw police states and slavery as socialist construction. It was attractive to some people who didn't want Stalinism to disintegrate and who were trained that a communist party, its first order of business is find some government, some state, some exploiting ruling class to fund you. That means it's an authoritarian ruling class ideology. And it then gets the same symptoms of Stalinism. It finds itself on the wrong side of revolutions and uprisings when they break out. It had to zig and zag as the Chinese government's foreign policy zigged and zagged, and it reproduced the worst practices of Stalinism organisationally, that bureaucratic inner life, that hostility to debate and theory, that working through violence, that intense sectarianism, anything outside the organisation has got to be destroyed, and that search for official positions and bureaucratic control by any means necessary. Those are the political methods of an exploiting ruling class that has agents trying to dominate a social movement. They're not the methods of an oppressed class that's seeking liberation, and they're the methods that the Maoists brought over into the movements that they influenced. They contributed, theoretically, a real indifference to the working class, and, or to put it another way, a real belief in the power of positive thinking. So, you know, if the peasant army can win socialism as it did in China, then for some people, students, unemployed, small, medium farmers, anyone can lead a revolution. That has implications. One of the American student Maoists said of their own organisation, there's not a magic moment when all of a sudden we become a working class movement. We're already that if we put forward an internationalist proletarian politics. And that was theorised in magazines like the Monthly Review as a major advance in Marxist theory. If you think and believe, then you are proletarian in every way that counts. And that was intensified again by all the zigzags that the Chinese government had to do. So think about it. According to the Chinese, in the 1950s, capitalists took over the Soviet Union. And by 1976, they were saying the Soviet Union was fascistic. That's despite there being no really significant observable changes in the political or social structure of the Soviet Union. In 1949, they said China was a new democracy. In the 1950s, it was meant to be a proletarian dictatorship. Sometime in the 60s, it stopped being a proletarian dictatorship in time for them to have to launch a cultural revolution to make it a proletarian dictatorship again. And the only thing that changed in that time was Mao and his core leadership's ideas about who was good and who was bad, who was on their side and who wasn't. If you're on their side, you're a proletarian. If they weren't, you were bourgeois or fascist. They also brought in some of the cultural norms of the Chinese ruling class at this time, which was having to terrorise and discipline millions and millions of peasants. And that, combined with the old-fashioned Stalinist conservatism, sometimes became super bizarre. The Maoists despised homosexuality. They were intensely, intensely homophobic. Mostly gay people were banned from membership of various Maoist organisations, and it was often discussed in really conspiratorial terms as something that was being promulgated by the United States to encourage degeneracy in the world communist movement. Ted Hill wrote a book, The Great Cause of Australian Independence, where he wrote about the Australian novelist Patrick White. This is the literature and art of national betrayal, national denigration. It's the literature and art of the traitor class. This stuff, books, pictures, poetry, films, is full of filth, degenerate and diversionary rubbish. The fact that Patrick White is hailed as a great man of Australian literature shows the monopoly capitalist view of literature and art. Their aim is to corrupt and disarm the working and other patriotic people. So this is like borderline fascist writings on literature, that extreme social conservatism. So you end up with this terrible situation where a form of Stalinism briefly manages to dominate the new left, or at least attain an influential position in it, if not dominate it. It was definitively unable to lead it anywhere good. Just on its disintegration, as I've said, it was a lot of the same pressures that led to the collapse of Stalinism originally, the sort of first run at Stalinism, as it were, those shifting needs of their patrons. So first, they said Khrushchev was a coward because he didn't want to launch a nuclear war with the US. Then in 1972, Mao has this diplomatic coup. He gets Nixon to go to China, and suddenly the United States and China are in a growing alliance. So at that point, the Maoists suddenly had to argue that, as they put it, Soviet social imperialism was objectively more fascistic than the United States, and that the United States could, under some circumstances, be a really good ally of the oppressed people. So some of them, like here, accidentally supported the nationalist uprising in Bangladesh, for example, in the early 70s, and then discovered too late that they had to oppose it because the Chinese government at that time was allied with Pakistan. It's just a little one. Just this sort of sums up where Maoism ended up. You can see here they've got their line on Pakistan in their placards. Indian aggressors out of Pakistan, stuff about how the Bangladesh uprising is a CIA plot. Up here you've got a big picture of Stalin, and it says Bolshevism, yes. Trotskyism, certainly not. So not really going anywhere in that sense. They supported the US and the apartheid South African regime at a certain point against Angola, because Angola was supported by the social fascist Russians. Ted Hill went to Cambodia to meet and endorse Pol Pot. At a certain point, they were under pressure to support the Liberal Party, because the Liberal Party was more anti-Russian than the Labour Party. And each time they zig or they zag, it threatens or it causes another split. So the Maoists just dwindle, and you can't really sustain a movement that's initially attracted people on a basis of Marxism, communism, international working class liberation, that ends up getting caught between Blinky Bill on the one hand and Pol Pot on the other. And then when Mao died, then you had the free marketeers took over the Chinese government, and the Maoists here had a choice. Hill, who was ever the loyal bureaucrat and couldn't really, I think, conceive of political life without some kind of a patron, just bit the bullet and endorsed the marketisation of the Chinese economy, which then put his organisation in a difficult and awkward position in the 80s here, when they were trying to attack the Australian Labor Party for marketising the Australian economy while endorsing the same thing in China. So they just sort of disintegrated, a number of them through their, you know, some who started in the student movement, then got positions in the trade unions, bureaucratic positions, some drifted into the ALP, one became the Premier of Tasmania, most of them just gave up. Some Americans just kept going on that search to find a surviving hardcore Maoist state that would back them, and they transferred their hero worship to it, which is why you do still occasionally get people around who uphold the immortal contributions of the Albanian Enver Hoxha. Most of them just collapsed, in their case, into the Democrats, particularly around the presidential campaign of Jesse Jackson. And apart from a few weird culty groups, they don't have an organisational legacy, really. People liked it because it was radical, or it seemed to be, but it wasn't working class radical. People admire states with flags and armies and police forces and so on. If you're going to be isolated politically, it's nice to have someone influential who's backing you. You can be a radical underdog, but you're totally in charge of your little bit of turf. These ideas in the radical socialist movement existed well before Marxism and have continued to exist after Marx fought them. State-led socialism, nationalist socialism, anti-working class socialism, conspiratorial secret socialism, socialism through guerrilla warfare, all things Marx had to argue against, and all things that are going to keep reappearing and that the Maoists made a serious effort to revive. But they introduced them to people who were motivated by pretty legitimate desires in some cases as well, not just figures like Hill who just wanted to run something, but people who wanted to really fight in solidarity with the oppressed, people who were willing to make a serious effort to investigate a radical worldview that was very different from what they'd grown up with, people who were sometimes defiant, courageous politically and physically, took these people and misled them and drove them into a blind alley where they could leave no legacy. I think for us, the main thing coming out of this for us today, in a time when it's a new question, or not a new question, but a question back on the agenda, is that there's no such thing as a radical Stalinism. Stalinism is a distortion of reality, and thus of Marxism. It's a worldview where slave-driving police states and warmongers who crush working-class movements are upheld as heroes, and it's an ideology of exploiters and oppressors and state-worshipping bureaucrats. And Maoism was a way to take that and rebadge it for the new left, and it only took 10 years for that to disintegrate, which is not very long. It's now having a small but, I think, real revival. It's a bit easier. People remember the cool shit, like the street fights. They don't remember the Blinky Bill stuff so much, or the homophobia, or the endless changes of line, or whatever. And ideas like it, I think, could potentially influence radical movements in the future, and that would be another disaster. And the other lesson about it, I think, is who gets there first often wins. The Maoists went into the 60s better organised and better prepared, ready to go, than many of their rivals. And I think that places a pressure on people who uphold authentic Marxism to get there first next time.